Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. As always, I am your host, Brian J. Rowan. With me, my two bandmates, there's Danny King, a writer for the Film Stage.
Hello, Brian. Thank you for having me.
You are lucky to get invited back every week. We also have Nick Newman, associate editor for the Film Stage.
Hello.
Hello. Today on the show, our 99th show, shall I add, we will be talking about Only Lovers Left Alive, newest film by Jim Jarmusch. It should be interesting. It is a film that it revolves around a couple, a literal couple, a man and a woman bound in some kind of romantic relationship of vampires who have been and continue to influence the art of humanity. And yeah, interesting little film, so we'll get into that. Before we get into that, we will have a brief discussion topic related to vampire films in general, so look forward to that. Before we do, let me tell you all again, as always, that we welcome your comments on iTunes. We look forward to them. We like getting rated. We like getting talked at. In that same vein, you can also look for us on the Film Stage, where we post these episodes. Feel free to comment there. We are looking and we are responding. You can always give us an email at podcast@thefilmstage.com. 99th episode. Guys, next week is our 100th episode.
It's quite a lot of podcast episodes.
It is.
Oh, God.
It is a momentous moment, and absolutely fuck all is coming out to theaters. We have looked, we have gone independent, we have gone wide release, and by God, there is literally nothing that appeals to us in terms of stuff that we can either see and talk about or stuff that we want to revisit. So look forward to our 100th episode. We'll figure something out, because it would be a shame to have to wait like a whole week when we're right on the cusp of this arbitrary milestone. But yeah, so sorry. Also sorry if you were expecting us to do Transcendence this week. We couldn't get out to it. It was Easter. We had time to see like one movie, and everyone had basically already seen Only Lovers Left Alive, so...
And I think ultimately, given the way Transcendence seems to have turned out, the choice circumstances added really did not seem appealing.
Right.
Just for some transparency.
I was looking forward to Transcendence in a way, and I was blown away by the terrible reviews. So, yeah, what was the point? I know it's fun to hear us rag on things. I think someone literally left that as a comment, that they really love it when we hate movies.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Like, it might have been one that just would have been funny to talk about.
It might have been. But I'm sure in this summer coming up that we have, there'll be plenty of things that we dislike, that we'll be surprised to dislike, instead of Transcendence, which honestly it seemed like, you know, what would be the fun in being another voice piling onto that? It's much better when it's something like The Avengers, where we seem to be the only three people who didn't think it was the tits.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's that. Look forward to whatever we're doing next week. Sorry that this is late in coming, this 99th episode. I'm never going to get tired of saying that. But, you know, like I said, holiday weekend, we were all busy. So we're recording Tuesday night. Hopefully get this out to you soon. And that's that. So as I said, we'll be talking about Only Lovers Left Alive. Before we get into that, we wanted to take a gander at the genre, if you can call it that, that this film is in. And that is the movie of the vampire. This is a thing. Like, I heard that Jarmusch was making a vampire film, and I thought, now we've done it. The Undead Bastards have become so popular that even Jim Jarmusch is doing it. And so I wanted to ask. I mean, obviously there's a hunger, if you'll pardon the pun, in our culture for films about vampires. A lot of that might be the youth generation that is obsessed with eternal beauty and youth and you know, energy, kind of clinging to that idea that you could stay that way forever. Part of it might be the sexiness of the vampires as exhibited in True Blood. Part of it might be because of a certain young adult fiction series that seems to have rocked the world to its very core. Who knows? But we're not going to really talk about that per se. What I want to hear from you two gentlemen is, what is your platonic ideal of a vampire film? When you think of the creature, bred in myth and brought up through pop culture, what do you want? Do you want horror? Do you want a treatise on immortality? What's the thing that would draw you to a film purely knowing is about vampires? What would you look for? So, Nick Newman, let's start with you. Platonic ideal of a vampire film, and has any film ever reached that lofty goal?
Well, I suppose there's sort of a remove with between myself and most of the options which are available as far as vampire cinema goes. I, because I think that sort of the basic concept of a vampire and sort of its most essential sketch is, I mean, it's a fascinating one, certainly, when you think of what most defines a vampire. You know, they have to survive on the blood of humans, and they can't go out during the daylight. They must stay inside around then, have an interest in medieval occult-type things. These are just sort of the most basic ways of looking at a vampire. I find that most movies don't really approach that properly. Even a lot of the ones I like kind of don't center on it too much. But I say a lot of the ones I like, which isn't to imply that I like a lot of them. To be honest, I mean, I guess really the two vampire movies, the three, I'll say the three that most appeal to me are probably two versions of Nosferatu, one by, of course, F.W. Murnau, another by Werner Herzog, which features Klaus Kinski as a vampire.
Yeah, you had actually talked about that one, I believe, on one of our recently watched segments.
Okay, yeah. I had seen that maybe about like a year and a half ago. It's a very good film. And also, another one I really quite like is Francis Ford Coppola's Dracula, with Gary Oldman as the vampire, which is one of the... I mean, Gary Oldman has no short supply of boisterous, overzealous performances in his repertoire. That is one of the most boisterous and one of the most overzealous of them all. And it's a good deal of fun. I mean, I think it's a very good Coppola movie, and I think that Coppola's sort of idiosyncrasies as a filmmaker do service to sort of the gothic overtones, something that he actually kind of revisited and sort of reappropriated in his film Twixt, a movie I also like very much, which also concerns vampires to some extent. But otherwise, I mean, you name a vampire film. I mean, there aren't that many other I'd like. I'm not a big fan of Catherine Bigelow's Near Dark. I know a lot of people are fans of it. I've never really gravitated toward it. Then there's also The Lost Boys, which is kind of fun. and what is another? Oh, The Hunger by Tony Scott, which is really wonderful when it's David Bowie and Catherine Deneuve as a vampire couple. Less so when David Bowie's character fades away. After that, it sort of becomes less about vampires specifically and more just drama. And I feel like if I'm going to see a film with vampires in it, certainly have drama, but I don't know, connect it to that particular lifestyle in some significant way. I feel like a lot of movies don't really do that, but Only Lovers Left Alive, one of the reasons I loved it is because I think it really handles that exactly as I want to see it. But otherwise, my platonic ideal of a vampire movie, I guess it's just something that uses the concept well. Otherwise...
But like, which aspects of the concept?
Well, as I had said, it's sort of, the gothic overtones, the feasting on blood, and also the being forbidden from walking about in the day.
Okay.
Also, you know what's in the vampire film is Blade. That's kind of a joke then. No, I won't count Blade.
All right. So Danny King, platonic ideal of a vampire film, and have any done it for you?
I think Mr. Newman got us off to a good start there. I would agree with him on most of the films that he mentioned that he liked. I think the Murnau film and the Herzog film especially speak to the potential atmospheric of vampires in cinema, because it is such a visually arresting character. And if you get an actor that can kind of match the concept of the character with like a deranged appearance or something, you can almost just present a dialogue-free film at that point, because the atmosphere is just so overwhelming and creepy, and like that gothic tone that Nick was talking about. Whereas on the other hand, a film like Only Lovers Left Alive, which is very atmospheric, but it's much more to me like a film about ideas and like the idea of a vampire, and especially immortality. And what's funny is, you know, the immortality of a vampire is kind of like an inherently cinematic subject, just because there are so many ways you can deal with that concept through time or something. Like, I almost wonder if Alain René should have directed a vampire film while he was still alive. But so I think that, like, my platonic ideal would be, like, you know, those two different routes, like one where you could go like pure atmosphere, or the other where you can really kind of engage with the ideas of the vampire. And then one other thing that came to mind is actually like about almost a year ago now on the site. It's weird to think that I wrote this a year ago. But I wrote a piece comparing the vampire mythos of Shadow of a Doubt and Stoker. And the reason, I mean, obviously Stoker is kind of a reworking of Shadow of a Doubt, but I took a Hitchcock class a few years ago, and one of my teacher's main ideas was that not only in this film, but in a lot of his films, Hitchcock kind of made his villains visually vampires, even though the stories never kind of state them. So like the opening shot of Joseph Cotton in Shadow of a Doubt, for instance, is him laying on his bed, like very straight as a board, and it's daytime, but the windows are closed, and he's in shadow. And when he eventually gets up in the scene, he gets up like very rigidly, kind of like he is this vampiric figure. And so I think what that speaks to is another possible route where you can make a film about like a vampire in quotes without kind of coming out and saying, this is my vampire movie. Or because like in my teacher's book, he does trace, and his name's Richard Allen. I don't want to like just take credit for his ideas. But he does trace in like dozens of Hitchcock films. Like one I watched recently was The Lodger, where it's about this, whether or not the main character is this kind of serial killer. And it has scenes of him going out at night, and there's like no scenes in the daytime. So I think that just speaks to going at the subject in an indirect way. And what appeals about that to me is just you can go into a film without the weight of the expectation that like this is so-and-so director's vampire film. You know, it could just be another film by them that incorporates vampiric ideas.
All right. So I guess for me, the platonic ideal of a vampire film is one that embraces, as Nick said, the idea of the feeding and the not able to go out in sunlight. I mean, these are very specific concepts that I feel like don't get played around with enough. But one of the things that I like most about kind of the, I guess, way back idea about vampires was the inability to see themselves in mirrors and their aversion to religious implements. Because at the heart, the concept of a vampire is really one of kind of corruption. And, I mean, their whole life is spent in murder. They gain their sustenance from the destruction of other life. And they take something basic about your humanity and destroy it. You're not ruled by love or passion. You're ruled by a thirst for blood. And I liked how there was almost like in an exorcism movie, there was a real commitment to the basic evil at the heart of this creature. It doesn't get played around with a lot, because movies that take the time to even bother having any kind of religious thing in it, it's almost like a form of magic, and they abandon any concepts of morality. Again, this might just be my Catholicism coming out, but I like the and it was done best, I think, in terms of not only having it, but also explaining it in the novella that was turned into a Will Smith movie, I Am Legend. If you only know the movie, you just forget about it.
Oh, man.
But the novella itself features the sole human left on Earth against vampires. Not CGI zombies, but actual vampires. And he discovers that there are the Christians who'd been turned into vampires were repelled by the cross. Meanwhile, his neighbor, who was Jewish, was repelled by, I believe it was a Torah. And it really delved into this kind of psychological aspect that there's a part of you within this creature you've become that recognizes the destruction of yourself. And so anything that kind of looks at it that way is interesting to me, because any movie that wrestles with morality is always interesting to me. I mean, you know, the human body is going to fail you at some point. And so the concept of someone wrestling for like their everlasting soul, this piece of them that might conceivably continue on, is far more interesting than just dying in general. It's just a deeper thing. So I love vampire films that really wrestle with that concept and that idea. And the other one is kind of this complacent march through time that they go through. So unfortunately, not a lot of modern vampire films help me out on the first half. But the second half, that march through time, I think was done really well in Byzantium. Did anyone see that? Because I know I talked about it a lot and how much I liked
it.
Oh, you bastards.
No,
I didn't. So this was...
I completely forgot about that, honestly.
Yeah, so this film was fantastic. It's about two women in Ireland, I believe, or possibly just in the UK in general, who are vampires and who are returning to this town from whence they came way, way back when they were still human. And it also charts kind of the progression of women throughout history. And it's really interesting how it ties all that together. It's not a pure vampire film. They can still go out in sunlight. They're a myth. I don't know if it was made for the movie or if it's specific to the British Isles, but it's called like The Revenant. But they still feast on blood. They're still immortal. There's a whole... It's basically a vampire film. The other one that I liked a lot was Let the Right One In, which I was surprised that no one mentioned yet. Have you all seen Let the Right One In?
Yeah, yeah.
Sure.
Let the Right One In has that same thing, that traveling through time. Not only that, but it has a vampire who's trapped in a child's body and who befriends this loner boy and who has to obey all those arcane rules. You know, you can't be allowed into a house unless you're invited. Don't go out in the sunlight, obviously. Already dead, doesn't need to wear shoes in the snow. So anything that really clings to that, I'm a fan of. So I find myself having to make a lot of compromises with films that purport to be about vampires. An interesting one that I liked, but that I don't really think of as a vampire film, is Thirst by Park Chan-wook.
Yeah, I like that film a lot.
Yeah. So, so that's where I'm coming from. That's what I want in a vampire film. No one that I know of has made one yet that really sinks in for me in that way. I did love Francis Ford Coppola's Bram Stoker's Dracula, but I think that was a lot about the performances and the actual artistry of the film itself, and Keanu Reeves with a British accent.
Oh, one film that I haven't seen that would maybe be interesting is Abel Ferrara's The Addiction, which I think is supposed to be like a pretty heady take on the genre, but I just haven't seen it.
No, neither have I. That's one I definitely like to catch up with, but it's a little hard to find.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I guess that's actually a good lead into our discussion about Only Lovers Left Alive, is that one of my favorite unspoken things about vampires is, and I mentioned this a little bit, the treatment of the thirst for blood as an addiction. Something, again, that a lot of places don't really go into. So let's talk about Only Lovers Left Alive, because that's one of the points of this movie that I really quite enjoyed. So Only Lovers Left Alive, the newest film by Jim Jarmusch. Was his last film was
The Limits of Control.
I loved that film.
Really?
I absolutely loved The Limits of Control. Why are you saying really?
I didn't know anybody loved it. That's kind of... to say it's a divisive movie, I don't think it's even correct. It's just kind of a...
It's just a movie that turned a lot of people off.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like The Counselor. I love movies like that. Movies that alienate even the people who seem like they should be into it. That was in 2009, so we've been waiting a while. We got it. So here it is, our take on Only Lovers Left Alive.
Give my regards to that suicidally romantic scoundrel.
Well, let's hope he's just romantic.
You being so reclusive in everything is probably only going to make people more interested in your music.
Yeah. What a drag.
Only Lovers Left Alive stars the only two actors, I think, who could convincingly play vampires without any need for any kind of, you know, CGI or overt makeup. And that is Tilda Swinton as Eve and Tom Hiddleston as Adam. Get your groans in now, I know. In the movie, Tom Hiddleston's Adam is a reclusive rock guy, rock and roll artist. More post-rock, actually, living in Detroit, secretly spreading
his... specified.
Where he's... What?
It was really important you specified. More like post-rock, just so listeners have...
You know, like a Mogwai, Godspeed You Black Emperor type.
Yeah.
He lives in Detroit and is secretly disseminating his music into the public, seeking no fame. And Tilda Swinton, as Eve, is living in Tangiers, in a room just crowded with books. Both of them are getting their blood from covert sources. The movie, I believe, takes place in the future. Not so far that there's, like, new technology. But it's an interesting thing because there's a constant kind of undercurrent about contamination of water and contamination of the blood and the kind of general decay of humanity. Things that Adam and Eve... Those names. Adam and Eve have seen before and are unhappy to witness again. So the movie's got a lot to it. It's a treatise on art. It's a treatise on the environment. It's a treatise on the short-sightedness of beings whose lifespans generally top out around 89, 87. As viewed through two completely alien eyes. Two sets of completely alien eyes. So Danny King, what were your thoughts on Only Lovers Left Alive?
Wow, yeah, that's a very interesting question.
It is, in fact, the question that we ask at the beginning of every...
It's appropriate that, on this podcast, you'd be asking my opinion of the film. I liked this film, I think, a lot. For a lot, I was sort of in this in-between state where I was really liking the film and appreciating it, while at the same time wondering, like, how deep it was digging, in a sense. And I think it goes to what Brian was saying about, like, how pitch perfect the casting seems, just on paper. And a lot of the film at first kind of felt like, oh yeah, this movie is obviously, like, really cool. Like, it's Jim Jarmusch making a film with Tilda Swinton and Tom Hiddleston about vampires that just collect art and talk about it. And so I think for a lot of the film, I was sort of teetering back and forth between, is this film actually really good, or is it just so much in everyone's wheelhouse that, like, it's sort of easy for them to pull off in a way. But I think by the end of it, I was really on board and positive on the film. And I think part of it is because its ideas about kind of accumulating knowledge of culture and stuff like that hits home for me personally, because that's something I worry about a lot, is like not having time to gather enough information. Like, basically anytime I read like a review of a prolific director and they're referencing you know, every single one of their films. And I always have the stress of like, well, how the fuck do you have time to watch every single one of these movies? And so that's an idea that like hits home for me. And like, it was funny to imagine a time where like, these two people would have time to learn everything and actually accumulate seemingly every piece of knowledge on the planet. So I had a lot of fun with that. And I also think that the way Jarmusch handles the atmosphere is really compelling. Like, the movie starts with kind of image of like the sky and stars, and then that swirls into a record player, and that sort of circling camera almost becomes the movie's like code, or it's like signature shot, because it's kind of trying to capture the time of these people. Like, they're kind of just rotating throughout existence. And that actually, at times, that has the effect of making the movie kind of intentionally boring or kind of stale, just because that's what their lives are like. And I feel like the actors are actively contributing to that, just from the way they say their lines. It's almost like they're bored out of their minds at times. There are a few actors that in like supporting performances that do it differently. Obviously, like Mia Wasikowska is like very charismatic, and Jeffrey Wright is really funny as the doctor. But Hiddleston and Swinton are kind of like trying to channel this hipster boredom that almost stalls the film and gives it this like really interesting pacing that by the end, I think I was won over by it. And I thought it was really kind of a good way to capture like the vampire concept.
Yeah.
So yeah, overall I would say, or maybe not, because
I mean, I can agree with you, but I can also say that it didn't work for me.
Yeah. Cause I think part of me is like, cause I did by the end, I was like won over, but I don't know if I'm gonna rewatch it soon, just because it does have like a pretty challenging pace, I thought, and sort of intentional like stagnation kind of.
Yeah, my problem with the intentional stagnation, though, is that, like, these guys may get to live forever, but I got places to be.
Yeah, I hear you.
And it really, I mean, like, I would be for, like, an entirely languid vampire flick that, like, trucks in that idea, I guess. But, like, really, there were times in this movie where I was just thinking to myself, like, what is the narrative here? Like, what am I watching? Like, these really are, to me at least, they're really, like, they're two hipsters bitching about all the stuff that hipsters usually bitch about, but they get to live forever, so their sense of abstract superiority is real, because, yeah, you don't have to worry about dying. You know, they don't have to worry about money either, apparently. They throw around cash like...
Yeah, money is weird in the film.
Drunk businessmen at a strip club.
Yeah.
So, but before we get into mine, even though I've just aired like one of my major complaints about the film, Nick Newman, what did you think about Only Lovers Left Alive?
Yeah, Only Lovers Left Alive, I loved. And for me, it was just a... you there?
Yeah, I just said, oh, God, because I know that it's going to be a fun conversation now.
I mean, for me, really the only reason I didn't want to keep watching this movie for hours on end is because I had to go use the bathroom by the time it was over. But otherwise, if I was just given a bit of time to go urinate, I would have gladly come back and watched another 2 hours with these people, if you could even call them people. To me, I mean, you know, we talked about sort of the ideal vampire film earlier. This fits in those things I consider crucial, but to me it also really takes it to an extra step, the way that it uses, I guess really for me it's just the way that Jarmusch is able to exploit the idea of a vampire to conform to his own interests. And Jarmusch has such a strong interest in various forms of culture. I think that's been evidenced throughout his films. And you know, it's the idea of, it's sort of the appeal, that initial appeal of, if you could live forever, think of all the great books you could read and music you could listen to, and in our case, all the films you could watch, but how you kind of settle into that malaise of it. And I mean, I think that sort of the central relationship between Tom Hiddleston and Tilda Swinton, in addition to the two of them just being so eminently watchable, I found is something, you know, the connection that these two form and the way that it's the way that it sort of evolves, but it's also very static at the same time. The way you get the sense these people are just sort of bound to be like so forever, or at least as long as they live. I mean, I don't know. That to me created the feeling of I could just watch this film over and over and over and over. And it has this very smooth, very relaxed pace that I think is beneficial to this sort of movie, because it's not really interested in having a plot because it doesn't actually need one. And I mean, I guess as a big Jarmusch fan, for me, there's a pleasure that comes in seeing him explore this new territory while still keeping his wits about him, almost in a way similar to something like Coffee and Cigarettes, which is an anthology movie that is anchored around those two objects, which are in the title itself. When he can do things like that, it's really great. One of the reasons I wasn't so keen on the Limits of Control was because to me it didn't feel completely identifiably him. This to me feels much more like a Jarmusch film, which doesn't mean that I'm asking him to do the same thing over and over, because I think that here he is exploring new territory. He is exploring history more. He's exploring various world cultures and myth. And not only that, but I mean, it's one of the first movies of his in a long time that I think has a really engaging romantic relationship at its core. Again, that might just in part come from Tilda Swinton and Tom Hiddleston being so much fun to watch play off each other, but nevertheless, that feeling is there. I was really a big fan of this, and that's, I haven't even mentioned the supporting cast, such as Mia Wasikowska, who I always like very much, and who I think fits the role of sort of like the selfish, slightly ditzy hanger-on quite well, and John Hurt as Christopher Marlowe, who it turns out is actually the author of all of Shakespeare's works, which that was fun. And Jeffrey Wright crops up briefly.
He does.
I
always like seeing Jeffrey Wright.
Yeah. So no, it was, to me, this movie was just, it's funny because I definitely know that I, you know, loved it, but I also, I feel like even having only seen it something like a week and a half ago, I've already forgotten a lot, because a lot of the movie for me is just these small incidents and these small gestures accumulating into snowballing into this portrait of a very strange group of people who I just wanted to, I wanted to keep following them. I wanted to keep seeing how they were going to continue to sort of fit these strange habits. Obviously I'm a big fan of it. I'll stop rambling.
Okay, I guess it's my turn. I found this film fitfully amusing, full stop. I guess a lot of my problems with the film stem from that pacing that Danny was talking about. I, as a fan of The Limits of Control, I don't expect a thrill-a-minute joyride out of Jim Jarmusch. I'm fine with that. But there is a sense in watching this film that I'm watching some very self-satisfied people sit around and be self-satisfied. And as a person who lives in DC and who has a lot of friends who are in both politics and arts, I could do that literally anytime I want. The only thing that makes it interesting is the concept of them being vampires and having observed this progressive march of humanity and whatever insights they might bring to that, as not just studiers of history but as people who have experienced it. And a lot of their issues with us come from our lack of appreciation for and ability to fully enjoy art, which it makes sense. I mean, I have that same issue with people who just want to go see Transformers and won't stick around for Tree of Life. I get it. I'm there with you. It's fine. We can go there. But I guess there's an essential remove from humanity in the viewpoint of this film as it is expressed, which again, I can appreciate, because a lot of times in a vampire film, vampires are viewed purely through the lens of humanity. And so seeing a film that more readily demonstrates how these people look at us is interesting. The issue that I have, however, is that a lot of the art that these two are talking about was made by humans and has been retroactively in this film's narrative been appropriated by them. There was a Schubert Adagio. There's the complete works of William Shakespeare. Though apparently, I think Adam wrote at least Hamlet. That gets thrown out at some point. So there's a general issue, because half of everything the movie's talking about is stuff that humans have made, which argues against its basic point.
It's interesting.
You know, it's like the newsroom. It's like, it's so easy for people on the newsroom to cover the news correctly because the show is taking place like a year and a half in the past, when hindsight has gifted us the knowledge of what's going on. It's easy for this movie to make a point when every piece of art that I could throw back at it, they can say, oh, that was made by vampires. You know, I guess. It's an interesting idea, but they don't even seem to do it out of benevolence. They do it out of some kind of sick malaise that they have. A malaise that I can't feel, because I'm going to die someday. And as such, it would be great if the movie would get to the point sometimes. I mean, I don't regret seeing it. I quite enjoyed it. I thought the performances were good. I especially liked Mia Wasikowska. She was fun. She was like her time in the movie was by far the most energetic and alive that the movie felt. Ha ha. Pardon the pun again. I loved Anton Yelchin. I find him eminently watchable in everything.
Yeah, he was hilarious.
Yeah, and again, Jeffrey Wright. I'll never not watch something Jeffrey Wright's in. But I kept wanting to, like, fight back against this general statement that the film is making. And maybe that's what it wanted me to do. Maybe it's a film that requires that you reassert the meaningfulness of humanity. In which case, congratulations, you done it. you done gone and done it. I mean, but there's just something elemental there where I was sitting there during swaths of this movie just thinking, like, get to it. Like, do something, for Christ's sake. Like, I know you're penned up in a house until the sun goes down, but, like, don't take me on a walking tour of Detroit and talk about how shit it's gotten. You know, I don't know. There's a general frustration that I have with this film that is very hard, if you couldn't tell, for me to put into words, even this far removed from when I saw it on Friday. And I just don't know what to do with that sense of alienation that, yeah, I felt.
One thing about, like, your problems with kind of their elevated opinion of themselves is, like, Jarmusch is walking such a fine line in this movie, and he's definitely aware of it, but it's this kind of problem where, and I'm saying this as a fan of the film, I'm just sort of voicing something that's all, but, like, there's a problem where so much of what's front and center in this movie is just Jarmusch's taste in art.
Yeah.
And that's kind of, like, can be a turnoff where, like, the scene, for instance, where Tilda Swinton is packing up all her books, it's really funny. But it, like, the scenes where, you know, they're just talking about records or performances, it's, I don't really need to watch Jim Jarmusch, like, prove to me that he is cultured and has good taste in art. Where that ends up working better is, like, and not to get into spoilers, but is this kind of climactic song performance at the end of the film where we actually are taken aback by a performer we've never seen, and she is amazing, and we actually get to watch her rather than hear the jaded people talk about it. So I think that's actually one reason why by the end of it I was won over, is because once they demonstrate it, we kind of get these two characters a little bit more, because it is like they suffer, or not suffer, but they're sort of catatonic through all of this for moments like that, where they stumble upon something new and it's a performance and we can like see that. Whereas when they're just talking about it, and when it's like a hipster joke, there is definitely like a dangerous zone that Jarmusch is working in.
Nick, any thoughts?
No, I mean, I didn't find it. I didn't think it was, you know, Jarmusch showing off how cultured he was or anything. I think it's just, I mean, for me, one of the more pleasurable points of the film was kind of trying to figure out how much he was sort of identifying with the characters at hand. One such instance, not that this is totally identification, but he has recently expressed the belief that Shakespeare did not write the plays he is credited with, for instance, which comes up toward the end of the movie. And, you know, that's one such instance, or he talks about the way characters talk about music sort of feels in line with the music he's had in his own films, particularly the reference to Jack White, I think. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, I guess I just found it kind of a sort of, I'm not a big fan of this term, but to me it felt kind of like a hangout film. It's like hanging out with a really smart, really cultured person. But I think he's inviting us into it. I think he's inviting us to have some fun and to just kind of enjoy that, to kind of
a lot of the times they were talking about art, it wasn't an appreciation. It was very self-aware. It was very like they had something to prove. You know, you have that friend who you'll be talking about something and then he'll have to come in and talk about that thing plus 20 other things just to kind of reassert his dominance in the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Like, these people would be goddamn insufferable to be around. And I was around them for like 2 hours.
Well, I don't know. I'm not sure. I mean, I think it's also about the way they're speaking to each other. I found it, I found it particularly enjoyable, and I don't know. To me, it was just about being in their company, and I found their company pleasant. I think there's a sadness at their core. I think that comes from, I mean, really, I think it comes from having experienced too much. I think that one thing that Jarmusch is saying in this movie is to kind of accept that you're not going to experience all the art you want to, and that really you should just appreciate what you can, and to understand that there's always going to be more out there, because at times this movie kind of feels like it's about hitting a certain wall in your own interests and mm-hmm. having little left to actually explore. And the truth is that, I mean, the whole vampire thing is almost incidental in that regard.
It's funny, because I actually like an idea that you put forward. Like, if I watch every movie that comes out in 2014, I get to go back over 100 years of cinema. I will never be out of stuff to look at.
Mm-hmm.
That is my, I guess, the gift of my mortality, is that I will never exhaust the experiences that I can have. A vampire, as ageless as they are, they will hit that wall.
Mm-hmm.
They will only ever be able to experience for the first time things which are new. That is an intriguing idea that I don't think is played out well in this film.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, now that you've said that, and now that I'm thinking about it, that would be a fantastic goddamn film. That is like exactly the type of thing that I would look for in a movie about vampires.
Mm.
You can't go back to the well. You can't visit the old places that you never got a chance to see because you were there.
Mm-hmm.
And so that concept of a vampire being almost entirely present instead of, you know, past, present, and possible future is insanely appealing to me right now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually making me dislike this film a little bit more, because that's such a powerful concept. Like, they have to go through periods of malaise where if nothing new that interests them is being produced, their life is basically in shambles. Damn it. All right, guys, we need to write a movie. I do wonder. Here's the thing: like, do we need a spoiler section for this? Like,
there's only one event in the movie that would be a spoiler, and I don't know if there is.
Oh, yeah.
I will just say that I think that as far as the sort of classic. A classic vampire action goes. I think this movie handles it very well by only having it happen once and having it happen once in a particular instance.
Right.
I think that... and also, one of the things I find funny is how they kind of don't seem... You know, they're sort of... It's not even a matter of why would you do that, you know, without telling us. It's more just like an inconvenience that somebody would do it at all.
Yeah, exactly.
Which I found
like, because control yourself, goddammit.
Right, because it shows that, you know, like any really good subversive depiction, it shows that there's always an extra component to this act. It's not just do this and then be done.
Right.
That you have to, you know, things get a bit messy sometimes.
I wanted to go back to something I said earlier. Am I wrong believing that this movie takes place in the future?
I don't think it does. What makes you say that?
I was thinking about it because there's a lot of talk about the contamination of blood and the need to get it from specific sources because it's like not impure. And what I thought for the longest time they were going to start driving towards was the proliferation of medicine.
Mm-hmm.
From my own personal life, every goddamn person is on a medication of some kind. Mine is alcohol, but other people have anxiety pills, bipolar, ADHD. If you get older, I guess you could go into things like Viagra and heart medications, statins and stuff like that. I mean, it would be interesting in my mind, again, for them to like wish for the good old days when if someone had high blood pressure, they just had to deal with it and they were considered fast food because their blood would pump faster into the gaping maw of a vampire. Whereas nowadays, every goddamn person on Earth is on something and that's causing a problem for them.
Mm-hmm.
What it comes out as, and it's not a spoiler to say because they begin to really delve into this constantly in the film, is that it's like water, like the water has been polluted to the point. And they at some point talk about like what percentage of human blood is water, and it's something like 98%. And the body is like between 65 and 70% or something like that. And so it's this concept of environmental pollution. They even talk about like a coming environmental disaster where like the American South is basically going to be on fire because it's so dry. And at some point, the utter corrosiveness of Lake Michigan is displayed. And I mean, like, that's not a thing that's happening right now. So I just, I don't know if it's supposed to be our present extrapolated a little bit, or if it's supposed to be like maybe 10 years in the future. Cause we don't get a lot of looks at technology and there's not a lot of cultural touchstones that we're looking at. You know, they don't talk about who's president or anything like that. And I was just curious if anyone else saw that and thought anything of it.
I'm not sure if there's really enough here to support the idea that this takes place in the future. I guess I have to wonder if that's even like an interesting approach, because for me a lot of the movie is kind of about looking at the present from the perspective of people who have lived longer than any other person on the planet.
Right, but see, this would go towards really supporting that thing I was talking about earlier, where to a vampire, it's all present.
Right.
Like, they don't give a shit about the geopolitics or the newest smartphone, even though Tilda Swinton is rocking an iPhone in this.
Sure.
I mean, it's just interesting that, like, if you were looking at the world through the eyes of a vampire, yeah, the differences would be purely convenience-based.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, part of that convenience is the ready availability of blood. And I don't think we're to the point now where you can't drink a human on the street because you're worried that there's some sort of toxin swimming around in their water. They even... they talk at some point about the oil wars and the coming water wars, like, you know, which is something that actually was in a Bond film, wasn't it? Quantum of Solace.
Oh, God, that's right.
They're talking about that.
That was the best Bond film. Tie-in.
So maybe they inhabit the same universe. I don't know. And like I said, I don't know if it adds anything to the film or not. But I was just wondering if I was the only person who picked up on that, because there were a lot of very subtle things in this movie. For instance, their propensity for wearing gloves,
mm-hmm.
which I'm not familiar with from any vampire lore, unless they're just constantly afraid of accidentally touching silver.
Right.
Which is, you know, it's a real concern, I guess. But yeah, I don't know. I just don't know. I don't dislike the film, but it's more frustrating than anything else, because if there was a guy who was going to do something interesting with this concept, it would be Jarmusch, and I would love to see that. And I was actually really looking forward to this. And I'm a little let down, you guys. I don't like being in this position. Not a fan of it, but that's just the way it is.
Yeah.
Any further thoughts on this film before we pack it up and get to the week ahead?
As much as I loved it, as much as I appreciated taking in all the little details, I could definitely see myself just having this on in the background a lot.
I want to listen to just the soundtrack.
Just the blurry. Well, yeah, the soundtrack is kind of one component of it. Just having it on and just kind of like listening to it, which isn't to say it isn't beautifully shot.
We didn't really talk about this. Visually, it's a stunning film.
Mm-hmm.
It opens with a extended sequence to Funnel of Love.
Yeah.
Where the camera is spinning towards these characters who are just lounging around as they're wont to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked it. Another thing I liked about this film actually was what happens to them when they drink blood.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The it's like a train spotting type moment.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, for me, the opening is really good in establishing two things. One is sort of how intrinsic these items of culture are to their own existence, the way that it matches with the spinning record.
Mm-hmm.
But also I just like think it's a really beautiful way of establishing sort of a certain immortality of these people as well. How the record just kind of keeps spinning and it returns to the same spot, but then it keeps going. And just as our image of them, sort of this circular thing, because, you know, a circle has no beginning, it has no end. We haven't seen their beginning. You can't even really imagine their beginning either.
Right. The only photograph you see them previously
is from 1868, I believe.
And it's their marriage.
Yeah. That for me was kind of the, it was just sort of the settling in moment that I really loved. So
yeah, I like that a lot too. There's a lot to admire in this film. But there's a lot more, I think, that was left off the table that's more interesting to me than what was shown.
Mm-hmm.
Again, especially that concept of, is this the future? Cool. Also, how does a vampire get a driver's license? There's a question that they never answer.
You can forge stuff. Yeah, I think if you're around long enough, you'll figure it out.
You'll figure it out. They probably have they have passports and stuff too, but.
Well, yeah, I mean, they have all those credit cards, you know.
They also have just a, like, boatload of cash just hanging around all the time.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of cash. But yeah, so that's my thoughts. This is out in limited release. I'd say it's worth a look. Yeah, even with all my reservations, I still found it appealing. And, you know, as you've witnessed here, it's definitely, it gives you something to discuss. So see it with a friend who you can talk about. With because
see
I
it
went
to discuss
saw this.
It, please.
Yeah, it's a conversation starter. I went and saw this alone. The theater had like six other people in it, and I left and I was like, well, this sucks. What the fuck am I supposed to do now? And then I went the entire weekend. I was with my family. You know, I love my family to death, but they're never gonna watch this fucking movie, so what am I supposed to do? It was hell. It was hell, you guys. So I'm glad we got a chance to talk about it. That's it.
All right.
So let's move on. Let's get into the selections for the things coming out this week. Coming to Blu-ray and DVD. Not much of anything worth talking about. I will say there's a Blu-ray of Get Carter, the original and the remake. Let's just stick to the original. Great Michael Caine flick from back in the day. definitely check that out. Nick Newman, you had said Riot and Cell Block 11.
Yeah, I'm interested in that. Directed by Don Siegel, released on Criterion. Also, Sorcerer by William Friedkin, a movie that
has been all over Twitter.
Yeah.
Saying that the only authorized transfer is the one on Blu-ray.
Yeah, he's been saying that. I mean, he's been working on a restoration for quite a long time.
Right. There's apparently a DVD out there that has it's very subpar, apparently.
It's pan and scan, which is crazy.
And he actually commented, unless I'll retract this if this turns out to be a fake, but I saw on Twitter someone posted a screenshot of a review that he left on the Amazon page for the DVD, not the Blu-ray, the DVD, that said, "I am William Friedkin. This is terrible. This is like unauthorized. Get the Blu-ray." So that's pretty interesting. Other than that,
there's also, I feel this is like the week where I'm like, I'm interested in films, or I want to recommend films that I haven't seen. Like the ones Nick already mentioned, Riot and Cell Block 11 and Sorcerer. Those are two directors I really like. And then also
Exit Wounds.
I don't know much about that. but there's an early Sidney Lumet film called The Pawnbroker that sounds pretty fantastic.
I'm going to throw out some love for the movie Torque.
Yeah.
Has anyone seen that movie?
No, I'd like to.
It is like a satire of the first and possibly second Fast and Furious films. It is like a fever dream inspired purely by the motorcycle posters that like a 14-year-old boy would put on his walls. So yeah, maybe Redbox that one.
I also just want to mention quickly a film called Master of the House by Carl Theodore Dreyer, one of the greatest filmmakers who ever lived, coming on Blu-ray from Criterion, 1925 silent of his. I want to see that. But every time I hear the title, I get that stupid song stuck in my head. Master of the House. No, I don't.
Master of the House.
I've never seen any production of that, so I'm
I've seen it on Broadway, off Broadway. Saw the movie, liked it. I have the original British cast recording. I'm pretty much all about Les Miserables.
Also, Quentin Tarantino's favorite film of last year, Big Bad Wolves, which I've mostly heard is awful. But that was like, that's right on the cover. It's like almost as prominent as the title, actually. Best film of the year.
Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah, so.
I mean, just because he likes it, don't make it good. I don't think anyone. Anyway, let's talk about what's coming to theaters because that's a nightmare. Coming to theaters April 25th, The Other Woman. I don't know. I'm not like interested in seeing this, but were I currently in a relationship and if my girlfriend wanted to see this, I wouldn't put up that much of a fight.
Ringing endorsement.
I'm just saying, like, I'm not going to go get some of the boys together and go see The Other Woman, but it looks like it has the potential to have some humor in it. The same could be said in an offensive way for The Quiet Ones, because that looks terrible.
I don't even know what this is.
Oh, it is a movie. I don't even know what it's about. From the trailer, it looks like it takes place in maybe like six different time periods.
Apparently,
it's all one narrative. Like, it's not actually. I think they just put Jared Harris in a vest, and I always see him and just assume that whatever he's in is taking place in the past. It doesn't look good, and it's one of these. So maybe I'm the only person who notices this shit. Has anyone noticed a proliferation of horror movies where some sort of badly CGI'd dark matter flies out of a young girl's mouth?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's a trend.
Like, The Haunting in Connecticut, I think, had that as a centerpiece of its trailer. Now The Quiet Ones does, too. Like, I don't know what it is about spectral intestines leaving a person's mouth that's supposed to be terrifying, but, like, at least render it well. I don't know. Let's talk about something else. Brick Mansion.
We should do a big feature on it.
That should be our 100th episode. Brick Mansions. This is an action film starring the late Paul Walker, the RZA.
Yep.
A
remake of the excellent District B-13.
Oh, it is. Oh, how about that? That's weird. Okay.
I'm
more interested in it now, but I still don't think I'll see it.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have a lot of stuff coming to limited release, which unfortunately I don't think we'll be able to talk about because none of it's coming to DC because apparently I live in a cultural hellhole. I can't say that. We got Lovers Left Alive and Under the Skin, so I'm okay. But no, I won't be able to see Locke on its first weekend of release, which sucks because it looks really good. Something called
Whatever Will You Do?
I don't know. We are coming up on our 100th episode. This is an important moment for us, and we're going to have to talk about The Quiet Ones, or, you know, Dora the Explorer. I don't know why that popped into my head. Spent too much time with little kids this weekend. Anyway, Young and Beautiful, the new film by Francois Ozon.
It's impossible for me to hear that title without getting the Lana Del Rey song stuck in my head.
Oh, no.
Which is fine, because I love that song.
In my head.
It's a great song.
I just watched The Great Gatsby again. And that song is used to haunting effect.
That's a great song.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Blue Ruin also coming out in limited. The German Doctor. A movie called For No Good Reason. Which actually, it's documentary. It could be fun.
Die Dr. Deutsch.
I was talking about For No Good Reason,
right?
Which is about Ralph Steadman. And then Walking with the Enemy. I can't really throw my weight behind any of these. I want to see Locke a lot, but, you know, I'm not going to encourage people to go see something that I can't see yet because I'm selfish. So, yeah. Anyone thoughts on anything?
I have seen Blue Ruin, so I can recommend that. That's a really solid thriller.
Okay.
I reviewed it on the site, so.
I would like to see Locke.
Yes, ma'am.
But otherwise, no, not much. I imagine Brick Mansions will work well when it's on one of the various premium cable channels in October.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that.
I don't know. It's funny because District B-13, if you have not seen it, is really terrific. Movie's a lot of fun. That's probably, maybe the best thing Luc Besson has put his name on. One of the best things he's put his name on, and probably the best thing he's put his name on since it came out, at least.
Are you forgetting about Lockout?
I never saw Lockout.
Oh, Lockout's so good.
I still need to see Lockout.
I kind of am a little curious as to how some of the action will be translated, because District B-13 is well known for its use of parkour, and I feel like Paul Walker is not probably doing that.
You know what's great, though, is that he's probably like the straight-laced private or straight-laced police officer, and then he gets paired up with a parkour guy.
Yeah.
And then they'll probably have some fun interplay with that.
Look at Wikipedia. The first official trailer was released on February 13th, 2014, featuring the song Turn Down for What? I find that kind of amazing.
Oh my god, that's a song. That explains like half of the jokes I haven't gotten in my office recently.
Oh really? You didn't know that?
No, I don't know shit about anything.
My brother texted me a joke relating to that song on Friday, and I went, hey, I actually got that.
No, someone was talking about like turn down service, and someone was like, turn down for what? Ah. And I was like, so you don't have to untuck your bed, I guess. I don't understand the joke. Now it all makes sense.
Do you just smash some glass object on your desk and go, God damn it?
I thought the thing was turn up. Like, I you know what, guys? I'm not hip. I don't know what the fuck is going on.
Sorry, man.
I might as well be a vampire.
I guess so.
We didn't talk enough about how awesome the post-rock in that movie was. Anyway.
It was good. Is there a soundtrack available?
Oh, there's fucking gotta be a soundtrack available, right?
I'll just look this up, because I feel like that needs to be in my ears.
I'll fucking download that.
Look at that, there is a soundtrack.
Great. Okay, beautiful. Anyway, let's talk about movies we've seen on
MP3 is only $8.99 on Amazon.
Boom, I'm getting it.
Yeah, I'm buying this right now.
I'm doing it right now, too. So Danny King, while we're buying the soundtrack to Only Lovers Left Alive, Why don't you tell us what's something you've watched on your own that you think we should all check out?
Oh, yeah, sounds good, man. So I actually have a very genre-appropriate recommendation. The 1973 film called Ganja and Hess. I watched it. It was streaming on Mubi, and it sounded pretty fantastic, so I gave it a watch. And about like 5 minutes into it, I was already thinking about actually not vampires necessarily, but Spike Lee's forthcoming film, which, you know, I just know the log line of that film is like people are addicted to blood. And Ganja and Hess is also about a man addicted to blood. So I was like, oh, man, this is going to be great. So doing some reading after the film was actually interesting because it was sort of, it was made on the heels of a 1972 film called Blackula, which was a blaxploitation Dracula film that was very successful, as you can probably guess from that title. And so this guy, Bill Gunn, was hired to write and direct Ganja and Hess. And rather than turn in a sort of conventional genre film, he turned in this incredibly deranged, weirdly edited movie that is not, it's just not a commercial film, even though it's really interesting. It stars Dwayne Jones, who was in Night of the Living Dead as this guy addicted to blood. And this woman played by Marlene Clark eventually comes in, kind of messes things up. But there's a lot of kind of really unsettling and complex racial politics in the film. A lot of interesting class kind of dynamics at work. And like I said, the editing is just insane. So if you can get a chance to check this out, I think it might be interesting to kind of revisit it within the context of Spike's new film. And I think a Blu-ray of it was released like a year ago or something, so that might be still readily available.
All right, excellent. Nick Newman, what about yourself?
Yeah, saw a lot in the last week, really a lot. I think what I'll go with is something that's kind of relatively available to people. It's a 1966 film called Seconds, directed by John Frankenheimer.
Oh, I know a lot about that.
Which, yeah, you probably, I mean, I imagine people listening to it are mostly familiar with it as of late because of a release by Criterion. And I was able to look at a release of theirs. Unfortunately, not a Blu-ray, but it was a DVD and it looked really beautiful. I mean, Criterion handling black and white photography is really one of my favorite things. And this movie uses black and white photography to great effects, sort of this very alienating cold world that an elderly man, well, not elderly, but middle-aged, approaching elderly, unhappy with his suburban life, decides to get out of. So he gets the surgery and he becomes this younger, more charismatic man played by Rock Hudson, but he is nevertheless depressed and he's trying to find his own way kind of out of this sort of unshakable feeling of despair. What's funny is that the movie is like a normal length. It's somewhere around 105 minutes. But I feel like you could basically summarize the entire thing in 15 words or so. It's really mostly about mood and it's really mostly about mood and atmosphere and sort of studying an actor's face to see how they can communicate certain feelings that seem uncommunicable, at least only communicable through words, because there is this really fascinating juxtaposition between the two leads. And it's funny because during the movie, I kind of forgot that I was watching the same character, and there was sort of a tension there being established, a tension outside of some thriller elements. The way it uses science fiction staples is really clever, and the way that it comments on identity as it relates to someone who works in New York City in the 60s pertains to a certain television program which has recently returned, which a lot of people, myself included, are big fans of. I refer to Two Broke Girls, indeed. And No, wait, I'm sorry. I'm thinking of Minute to Win It, the NBC game show Minute to Win It. Yes, but overall, yeah, Seconds I liked a lot. I'm actually liking it more as time goes on. When it ended, I wasn't so sure how coherent it was. And ultimately, I think that really it's a matter of a film that is kind of establishing a lot, but it's only really looking to say a little. And what it says, not what little it says, but what it says in that limited scope, I think is very effective and actually rather moving. Seconds by John Frankenheimer, you can access it pretty easily, I think, nowadays. I would definitely recommend checking it out. It kind of has, I don't want to say it has a little bit of everything, but it has quite a bit that you can sort of parse from in terms of what you're looking for in a specific viewing. I mean, I just got pleasure from the character at the beginning gets on a train and he goes to Scarsdale, which is one of the train stops when I go to and from school. And, you know, just sort of like this study of 60s suburbia right near where I live is kind of its own weird, fascinating thing that's just nestled into this movie amidst so many other things. Seconds. It's got a lot going for it. It has a lot going on.
I would love that to be the pull quote.
It's got a lot going for it.
Seconds. It's got a lot going for it.
Yeah.
Okay. I guess it's my turn. Here's the thing. I didn't really watch anything new. I was busy a lot and then with family. So the weekend that I would have taken to watch something and be able to talk about it didn't happen. So here I'm just going to do a quick rundown. Feel free to comment as you desire. Rewatched Pitch Perfect. Slightly drunk this time. Not unbearable. Music scenes are great. Well, not great. Music scenes are good. Enjoyable, and you know, there's some effective comedy and romance.
I don't think I will ever see that film.
That you are no poorer for having not seen this film than I am for having seen it.
I've seen parts of it.
And it's tonally insane. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, I said tonally, not totally. It is tonally insane. But there are some interesting parts of it. It's interesting. It's fun. Have a good time. See it drunk. What else did I watch? Like I said, rewatch The Great Gatsby. Holds up. Really good film.
Does it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Quite enjoy it. Having seen it already, I was able to focus more on the emotional core of the story. And it actually is a little stronger on the second viewing because you kind of know the beats that it's going to go through. It's like when you hear a song and you're like, damn, that's a catchy song. And then you hear it again and you're like, holy God, this is about a person overdosing on heroin.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't ruin the catchiness, but it also adds a new layer.
Yeah, you might also know the emotional beats because it's based on one of the most famous novels ever written.
I'm saying, like, from a narrative standpoint, like, I wasn't sure how well it delivered on the heart of the novel.
Mm-hmm.
But having seen it now and not being wowed by the 3D and the editing and everything, I can say that the emotional core of the novel is intact in this movie. So very good work, Baz Luhrmann, Leonardo DiCaprio, all involved. Yeah. Doesn't hurt that Carey Mulligan is gorgeous. That does not hurt at all.
You know who else I like?
Who else?
Elizabeth Debicki. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No. She's stunning.
Yeah. She was. Man. Anyway, moving
on. This is gross. This is really...
Rewatched Trance because...
Oh, no.
Yeah, Trance.
A month ago, I was like, hell yeah, I want to see Trance again, and I couldn't find it. And so this time I saw that it was on, like...
Were you hit on the head?
HBO.
Is that what happened?
It's possible. I might have forgotten that I'd seen Trance. So here's the thing. Watching Trance again, and I was like, you know what? Maybe now that I know how it's going to go, I can just enjoy it. Incorrect. I was blown away by that opening scene with the voiceover and the camera angles and everything that you want from a Danny Boyle heist film. And then it just completely goes off the goddamn rails again. Like I knew it would. And I was so pissed off again. It's a movie that had so much going for it. And yet somehow, even knowing where it's going to go, aspects of it were still just infuriating to me. So I gave it another shot. It wasn't good. Rewatched Ruby Sparks. Still a fun film. Great performances. Really powerful. Interesting. It goes a lot of places that you wouldn't expect a film like that to go. I think I'm done. I think that's it.
Wait, you like Ruby Sparks more than Trance?
I do. I like Ruby Sparks a lot, actually. I think it's an interesting meta-commentary on the concept of a manic pixie dream girl. I think it gets a lot right about writing and how a writer views the characters that he creates. And Chris Messina is in it, and I always love seeing him when he's just doing his, hey, I'm just a normal guy, and I'm really sarcastic and witty, and I'm funny type of thing. So great, good times, fantastic. I'm sure I saw a bunch of other stuff. I watched like 30 minutes of The Nutty Professor with Eddie Murphy.
I thought it was the Jerry Lewis one.
No. That movie doesn't hold up so much. That's that. I'm done. That's my crazy ass rundown of all the disparate shit that I saw. So let's get out of here. Guys, let's tell the people at home where we can be found. Ladies and gentlemen, be sure to tune in next week when we have our 100th episode and we talk about something. So Danny King, where can we find you on the internet?
All over.
Great. Dick Newman. Danny King, where can we find you?
Internet.com. also thefilmstage.com. KingBulletin.com. Twitter.com/TheKingBulletin.
Do you know that there is an internet.com?
Yes. Or no, I don't.
I just went there. It's weird. Anyway, Nick Newman, where can we find you online?
Thefilmstage.com and Twitter.com/Nick_Newman.
And I can be found at DearFilm.net, my personal site, as well as thefilmstage.com and Twitter.com/BrianJRowan. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us. Tune in next week for episode 100 of The Film Stage Show.
You want me to hear something kind of, want me to say something kind of funny? You cannot hear this.
Okay.
Oh, wow.
So I
not even at the end as a blooper?
No.
Okay.